The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
This program was recorded on April 21st, 2015.
Welcome to the Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Each week, WVUD hosts different artists to talk about the music they play and the lives they lead. Stay tuned for the Music Room on WVUD.
Hi, I'm Abby Sarfo, and welcome to the Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Tonight we have part two of our two-part interview with Pete Moore, bass singer and founding member of The Miracles. At the end of part one, we left off with Pete talking to former Mojo Hour host Phil Barnes about the discovery of Motown's other legendary artists. So, let's get right to it. Here's Pete Moore.
We're all from Detroit, you know, we all knew each other, we all grew up with each other, and so forth. And Barry, he went to Sporting one day, and he said, you know, I heard that there's a group that lives in a project. And he was referring to Diana and the Supremes. And Diana and the Supremes didn't live around where we live. You know, like Smokey and I had been this across from each other. I live on the same street that Jackie Wilson lives on. In the Four Tops, they live like around the corner, you know. So we all knew each other, we all went to school together. All kids, but down around the Supremes are from the projects on the east side of Detroit. So he said, why don't you guys go over there? He said, I heard these girls are really good. He said, why don't you go over there and give them an audition? You know, so we went over and we auditioned them. And we were very impressed with these three young chicks. They could sing, their harmony was great. So we went back to Barry and said, man, these girls are really good. So Barry ended up signing Diana and the Supremes. And then one day, Ronnie White's younger brother went to school with Stevie Wonder. Okay, now Stevie was about 13 at the time. And Ronnie's brother came back and said, there's a blind kid that I go to school with. But, y'all always check this kid out. He's a friend of mine, you know. So they gave a high school dance, and then we went to the dance, and we seen this blind kid sitting at the piano, man, just singing and just blew everybody away. So we said, man, we need to take this kid to the company, you know. So we took him to the company the next week, and I can remember this like it was yesterday. Stevie is one of the pure geniuses in the history of this industry. And that word genius is very loosely used a lot, you know, but in Stevie's case, that doesn't apply. He came to the Motown offices, and he started off playing the drums. Okay, now mind you, Stevie was only 13. Then he went from the drums and started playing the piano flawlessly at 13, blind.
Yeah.
Okay? And then, you know, he started playing the harmonica, and Barry looked at all of us and said, wow, where did this kid come from? So, in short, we discovered Stevie. So Barry signed Stevie, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
You know, and then all the other artists that we had a hand in signing with Motown. Marvin Gaye is not from Detroit. He's from Washington, D.C. Okay? And there's a gentleman by the name of Harvey Fuqua, who is the original member of the Moonglows. I'm sure you remember that group. You know, back then, the Moonglows were doing movies, Ready, Steady, Go, and so forth. You know, and Marvin became a member of the Moonglows. And Harvey had heard about this company that just opened in Detroit. He said, I'm going to bring Marvin to Detroit. So he brought Marvin from Washington, D.C. into Detroit. And Marvin had an audition. And Marvin is, what can you say about Marvin Gaye? I mean, and we were all young at the time. But Marvin started singing, and he started playing the piano. Now, Marvin is another genius.
Yeah, he's got an angelic voice, for sure.
But not only that, he was a hell of a musician, you know? And the things that he sang at the audition in Motown, he was playing piano, flawlessly, you know? And Marvin was a hell of a drummer as well, you know? And before Marvin started to write for himself, Smokey and I, well, Barry came to us and he said, look, man, this kid is something else. Why don't you write some songs for him? So Smokey and I wrote a song called Ain't That Peculiar when Marvin got a little older.
As Pete just said, from 1964, this is Ain't That Peculiar by Marvin Gaye. You're listening to WVUD.
Honey, you do me wrong, but still I'm crazy about you. Stay away too long, and I can't do without you. Every chance you get, you seem to hurt me more and more. But each hurt makes my love stronger than before. I know flowers grow to rain.
In the beginning of Marvin's career, you know, he was our drummer, you know, because he was a fan of ours. Now, we was a big group at the time, right? They had all these hit records, you know, so Bob said, I was like a big drummer for you guys. So we took Marvin along the road with us, and he played drums for us for a year and a half, you know, before he started doing any recording, you know. So Bob was getting a little older. We all marveled at this guy's talent. And that's when Barry said, look, when you guys write some songs for him. So we wrote a song called I'll Be Doggone.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And another song called Ain't That Peculiar, Smokey Eye. And those songs just exploded. That kind of helped Marvin get out there initially in the early part of his career. And then the staff writers wrote a couple for him as well, How Sweet It Is. So Marvin is becoming this big star. Now, this is before he started writing for himself.
Well, that's one of the things that I always appreciated about Motown is that, you know, it was a fraternity and the brothership at the label where, you know, I mean, you would all sing on each other's tracks and you would write songs for each other. And there was no, you know, there was very little me. It was all about us at Motown. And, you know, that's... It's part of what made it such a successful label, and you know, cranking out the hits like you guys did.
I couldn't agree with you more. As a matter of fact, what you just said is the main ingredient that catapulted Motown into superstardom as a record label. You know, because we were a family, you know, and we loved each other. You know, there was no animosities, no jealousies. Anything of that nature, you know. If Marvin called us up and said, "Look, man, I'm doing a song. I need some singers," the Miracles would come down, do background vocals for him. You know, Martha would call us up and say, "Look, I need some support on this song, this and that." You know, the Temptations, that's a short for Temptations. You know, would call us up and say, "You know, look, guys," and vice versa. You know, we would call these guys up. Now, when you listen to the song, What's Going On, you hear all them voices and all the stuff. That's all of us.
Oh, that's all you guys.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, so there was no animosity among the Motown artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first of all, we were fans of each other, you know. Man, the Miracles were fans of the Temptations. Temptations were fans of the Miracles. The Miracles were fans of Diana Ross and the Supremes, you know, because we just discovered them, so we maintained that relationship with Diana, Flo, and Mary. You know, we were all friends. We loved each other. We wanted everybody to become a star. You know, there was no jealousy. And then, of course, we all loved Berry Gordy, the founder, because Berry Gordy's dream was to develop a company that would be national. So we all rallied around him as well. It was just a love fest.
Right now, we're going to take another brief pause from the interview for some music by The Miracles. From 1964, here's You Can't Let the Boy Overpower the Man in You on WVUD.
Now don't you know my daddy told me right from the start of my youth. He said no matter how
about Motortown Revue, because I can imagine, you know, you guys are doing all this in Detroit and helping each other out in Detroit, and then you go on the road in the 60s with Motortown Revue. What was that like?
That was an adventure that it was a challenge
mm-hmm.
for us.
Because of where you went?
Yeah, because of where we went. You know, because you have to remember, you know, that was during the Civil Rights Movement.
Exactly.
Okay. So when the Motown Review went down south, you know, we were subjected to a lot of racism, Jim Crow, you know, by us being a black company and having black artists. But fortunately for us, when we appeared in the South, the white kids loved us. I think the white kids was even more so than the black kids did, you know. And they would come out, and they would come to our shows, and, you know, they would stop by the dressing room, and we would start talking to them. We were thrilled, you know, that we had a lot of white fans back in these days, like in the early 60s, 61, 62. And the kids used to tell us that, you know, they would listen to black radio to hear our songs, you know, because back then, black music was still considered race music, and the pop stations didn't play a lot of Motown back in those days, you know, because of that. And white kids would tell us that they would listen to black radio so they could listen to our records, and, you know, they would sneak and hear, listen to our records at home, and their parents would find out that they was listening to black music. They would break out records. Our records were all vinyl back in those.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of support from the young white kids.
Did you feel like you were doing something down there? I mean, did you feel that your presence down there and the conversations that you're having with the white kids that you're actually making a larger social impact beyond the music?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you see the film Ray?
Yes, I did. Yep.
You remember in that scene where he was down south and he refused?
He refused to go to the...
Okay, and one of the venues that we played, I think, was Charleston, South Carolina. You know, because back in those days, the black audience would be up in the balconies, and the white portion of the audience would be on the main floors. That's the way it was back in the South in those days. So this performance, we had played, I think it was South Carolina, I can't remember the city. It's been like 50 years ago. But we were in the dressing room, and, you know, we said, you know, we didn't want to go on because of that, you know, because they had all of the black fans in the balcony, and they had the white fans in the on the main floor, and everybody was dancing. And that's the way things were back in those days. You know, so we went to the promoter, and we went to his office and said, look, we're not going to go on. And they said, well, why? And we said, it was Smokey. He said, well, you know, why do you have the black kids in the balcony and have the white kids on the main floor? And the promoter got a little insulted, but he said, look, that's the way it is, kids. So you're down here in the South. So we refused to go on. So about 15 minutes later, there was a knock on our dressing room door, and the promoter let the black kids come down to the main floor, white kids. And the reason I asked you, did you see Ray? Because Ray went through the same type of thing back in those days.
Yep. Well, it was in some ways it's a different time today, in some ways it isn't. You know, I often play a lot of music that has some fairly strong social commentary. I mean, you know, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and some Syl Johnson and artists like that. And, you know, obviously Sam Cooke and, you know, music had a message, beyond being a pleasure to listen to as a pop record. And,
right.
I get the sense that that's sort of, you know, an artist wouldn't make that stand. It'd be a little bit more difficult to make that stand, but there is a reason why they don't have to make that stand anymore, because because we've come so far, you know, since that time.
Oh no, that was in the 60s, man, the late 50s. You know, where you still had a lot of racism, you had a lot of Jim Crow. That was during the time the Montgomery boycott. You know, people were going to get the lunch counters, you know, trying to desegregate lunch counters. This was during the Civil Rights Movement.
And did you feel pressure like as you're composing songs, because you're also a songwriter, did you feel sort of a moral obligation to write songs, or were you encouraged not to because of the political content? I mean,
didn't have anything to do with the civil rights movement. You know, because when you listen to the songs that I wrote and the songs that Smokey wrote, and those songs were based on just human behavior and how human beings reacted with one another. And most of the songs that we wrote back then were love songs, you know, like Ooh Baby Baby, Tracks of My Tears.
Exactly.
And so forth. Going Through a Road, that was just a fun song, you know. But we were taught by Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, to try to write a song that people could relate to, okay? And that's the way Smokey Robinson and myself and the other writers at Motown, we always wanted to pick a subject matter that we thought that people could relate to, okay? And that was a premise of how we wrote songs back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Tracks of My Tears is kind of an exception. You know, there's a play called Pagliacci, okay? So this clown that always appeared to be happy on the outside, but he was sad on the inside, okay? So Smokey and I were sitting alone one day, so Marv Toplin, our guitar player, played a riff for us on his guitar. And we were trying to think of a subject matter to write the song about, and we thought of Pagliacci. So why don't we write a song about a guy who appears to be, you know, happy on the outside, but he's always sad on the inside. So we started writing Tracks of My Tears. People say I'm the life of the party, cause I tell a joke or two, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But although I'm laughing hard and hardy, deep inside,
I'm blue, yeah.
So take a look at my face. You see, the smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears. So that's how we wrote that song, based on this Pagliacci. The songs that we wrote didn't necessarily have a social content. As I said, you know, we wanted to write songs that people could relate to.
Well, Pete, I could tell you you were massively successful in that effort. And I enjoyed listening to, you know, as I mentioned at the top of the interview, you know, from Michigan. And I remember, I mean, I'm only, you know, 35, skinny white boy,
yeah.
Skinny white boy from the UP. But I can tell you that driving around in the car extensively as a youngster, you know, you got to drive everywhere. So you spend a lot of time in the car. And my parents would always have the oldies station on. And being in Michigan, they would play a ton of Motown. And so I grew up basically listening to you and your Motown friends. So I know that you've been massively successful.
Like I said, that guy that was in our audition, okay? The guy that we auditioned didn't like us. And the guy that was in the audition ran to our cars and said, "My name is Barry Gordy. I'm looking for a group to manage." That was just God. The only way we look at that.
Well, Pete, I appreciate you talking to us today. I wish you the best. It's been a good interview. And before we turn it over to the Zero Hour, we're going to listen to Tracks of My Tears.
Joke or two, although I might be the laughing loud and hearty deep inside.
Thanks for listening to The Music Room on WVUD. For more information about this and other episodes of The Music Room, including selections from the interviews and information about the music, visit us online at sites.udel.edu/TMR. Tune in next Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of The Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark.